Hey everyone, it's another episode of Society 9, the Fight Within podcast. My name is Lynn and I'm the founder of Society 9. For those of you who are joining us the first time, Society 9 is a modern women's boxing brand providing boxing gear and sportswear to empower you and your fight. I am so honored and excited to have our guest today, who is Angela Jennings. She is the co-founder of Boombox Boxing in Washington, D.C. This community is really special. It was founded by Angela and her partner, Reggie, and it was founded based on their love for boxing, music, and community. And their goal was really simple. It was to empower and inspire, but also making the health benefits of boxing-inspired training accessible to all fitness levels and backgrounds, which, of course, is what we are all about here at Society 9, is making sure that everyone has an opportunity to uncover their own personal strength and power through this journey that is boxing and beyond. So Angela, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Excited. Yeah. Thank you for having me, Lynn.
Absolutely. So just for context for everyone who's listening, Angela and I actually had an IGTV live a few months ago that was awesome. We had really great engagement from it and we talked about a lot of things, not just working out. Actually, I don't even think we talked much about working out.
We did it.
Which I loved because I think our industry needs to hear more stories and more perspectives. And I'm just really humbled that you have trusted our community to share both your journey as well as what it's like to navigate the fitness industry as a powerful career Black woman and then entering the industry, starting the gym, and now entering COVID as well. There's just a lot of layers around your personal journey as well as where the business's journey is at, and then your journey as an individual. But would love to hear directly from you, of course, and for our audience who are not familiar with you or Boombox Boxing, how did you get into the fitness space? What led you there? What made you decide to do this? And then we'll go from there.
Absolutely. So again, thank you for the beautiful introduction. You actually did a lot better than I could have done. But to add to that again, I've been in sports, I should say, my entire life, starting out as a cheerleader. I played basketball. I ran track. Track was really my sweet spot and where I found my home in sports and in fitness. And so I was always interested in being active and really active with other people. I enjoyed working out with other people, no matter the differences in our fitness levels, our general abilities and capabilities. It was just kind of fun seeing other people, seeing us challenge each other to just try to do something in movement. I think, and that's kind of what led me to my journey with Boombox and meeting my business partner, Reggie. We met each other. I think, everyone kind of knows the story. We met on Tinder, on a dating app, even though, for us, we actually never dated, but we were still, Reggie always says, I'm still your best Tinder match to date. And he's the only one that's still around.
Hear that, but, y'all? You could find your future business partner on Tinder. Like, don't knock it.
Yeah, and I think now we're 7 years in, and so it's crazy even when we think about it. But we met and we started working out together. It was the same thing, and that's how we realized we shared some of those same traits and just challenging each other and then kind of pumping each other up when we tried something else that, we hadn't tried before. And we made that small accomplishment and celebrated, even the minor step in getting something right. And, fast forward, us sitting down having a conversation one day, it's kind of like, what do we really want to do when we grow up? Both he and I are in the finance industry, finance and accounting. I'm a CPA by day. I always say that.
But I'm going to call you about my taxes.
Yeah. Seriously. And I actually hate doing tax, but you can't get away from it, right?
That's right.
But, and talking about just kind of our values and kind of sharing the spirit of, motivating and, being accessible and, other people just kind of having this feeling of winning and not winning in the sense, again, like winning every race, but just that accomplishment. I did more today than I did yesterday, or I tried something new. Mm-hmm. And Reggie actually was a person that was into boxing and who introduced me to boxing that I was totally against initially. Again, I played completely non-contact sports. But it's something that he introduced me to. And as I picked it up, I completely fell in love with it. And again, sitting down, thinking about what we wanted to do, you know, magically or not magically, but, you know, over time, the concept of Boombox came about. And all those elements that you mentioned in terms of, you know, accessibility, just kind of empowerment, you know, motivation, making people feel inspired, making people feel strong. You know, the thing that we say every day is we're all fighters. We're all fighting for something. And to bring that concept together in the space that is called Boombox is something that we're so, you know, adamantly proud of. And it's so funny, we use the term fighter. And I feel like for all of us, not just in 2020, but definitely in 2020, it's really highlighted the fact that we are all fighting every day for something, mental health, physical health, just to be able to be, again, with us, you know, with everything that's going on, you know, with George Floyd and a part of the conversation we're here to talk about today. I mean, the fight has really amped up so much for all of us. And this year really been a highlight for all of the things that we're still very much fighting for.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the context, for our community, for our audience. And I always love feeling a kindred spirit for the passion, for, you know, the passion that we have for what we do, because, you know, you were saying how, like, what you and Reggie are motivated by is encouraging everyone to feel a sense of accomplishment every day versus, like, necessarily moving towards just that one objective, which, you know, is, I think, when people think about boxing, or, you know, mixed martial arts, combat sports, whatever, there's this idea that you have to pursue this greatness competitively. And it's like, no, it's so, you know, I remember coaches in the past saying to me, you know, 90% of the game is mental, you know? And so and especially what you said now about this energy and this fervor around what philosophically the fight means, and how, especially boxing is becoming a little bit more becoming much more mainstream accessible, how that triggers people or inspires people to maybe tap into an energy they never even knew they had, or like never thought about considering. So for you, I mean, right now, the last time we left off on our IGTV, our live, you had not reopened yet. You were prepping for a reopen, which I recall was like right after 4th of July weekend. Walk us through that journey. Like, what was that like, you know, from the eyes of a gym owner in Washington, D.C., you know, what was the environment like getting ready for that? And then once it actually did happen.
So for us, it really felt like opening day all over again, but it was much more scary. It was a little bit deja vu because we opened in July of fiscal year, but of 2019. And we are now.
Can't believe that was a year ago. It feels like an eternity.
It was so long ago, and it happened overnight at the same time. It's like, I mean, I'm pretty sure you can understand that you're like, we're here already, but at the same time, it was like, I never thought I would actually get here. And getting here after literally physically shutting down your space, and now you kind of have this, you know, we're ready to reopen. And the biggest question was, is anybody going to come? Which is the same question you have on your first day of opening, for very different reasons, of course. But, you know, do people feel safe? You know, are people comfortable in coming into a space where we're all living in this time of something none of us are familiar with? It's very brand new. And so, you know, have we checked all the boxes in terms of, you know, the standard protocols for safety, for COVID, you know, are we making sure we reduce capacity, we're social distancing, we have hand sanitizer everywhere. I think my skin literally is fall off from all the hands.
I have bottles of lotion strategically placed around the house, because literally between the washing and the hand sanitizer, like, I'm sure all of our hands literally look like they've aged 20 years.
Seriously. And it really was, you know, and even if people come, you know, we're operating at such reduced capacity. Like, what do our economics look like for us to reasonably think about sustaining, you know, not even, you know, just in the short term, but like, how can we manage sustainment through 2020? And so for us, it was really, you know, we were very unsure. But we were very adamant about opening. We sent out a survey to our members to see how comfortable they were in returning, given, you know, we needed to push our space back. And even though DC allowed some gyms to open, I believe, early June, we really just wanted to kind of take our time and make sure that we truly understood all the protocols and the requirements. And then we wanted to survey our team, our members, and just understand their general comfort levels. And I think, you know, and as our industry goes, generally for the summer, you know, it's not as popular as, you know, the fall season, and definitely in, you know, starting January, February, that winter season. And so while it's
Is that because of the heat?
Yeah, and I think, you know, generally speaking, people are, you know, if students are here, they're back home, you know, people are on vacation. Yeah. So the summertime, people aren't necessarily gymming as much in their regular spaces as they are even in getting out. And, you know, now I think we've seen like the upsurge in bikes. Everybody is cycling these days and doing different things. But we opened on July 6th. We reduced our capacity. We allowed 30, our classroom holds 30, 29 spots. We reduced it to 11.
Wow.
And, you know, somebody came, and, you know, the first day it was maybe 9 or 10 people, but then we started filling classes, and we wanted to try it by reducing our schedule capacity and seeing how many people would come. And as people come, we continued to add on to the schedule. At the same time, we retained our virtual classes that we were doing online. However, we've seen those dwindle as well. And I think it's a combination of, like you said, it's summer, but also virtual fatigue. We are tired of being in our living rooms. You know, we're working in our living rooms. Our children are now, you know, doing school at home. And now I have to sit in front of this exact same screen and attempt to work out. And so I think, you know, it's an interesting dynamic that our entire industry is coming to figure out. But it's going to be interesting to see how, if more people are going to say, you know, and now that I've been in front of my screen all day, I've watched my children be in front of their screen all day, do I want to stand in front of the screen and work out, or am I okay, or am I comfortable enough to go into another space and work out and do fitness? So right now we're doing okay. We finally found some additional space to hold outdoor classes, which are doing very well. That's so good. I'm hoping that, you know, those continue through the fall, and we'll continue, you know, like everyone else, we're monitoring and we're figuring out daily. But right now I'm pretty pleased. I'm really happy. The members who returned are, you know, very pleased with how we're managing. And they're showing up, and they're showing up really just ready to work, ready to fight, ready to support. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's really, you know, as we know, it's their outlet. They want to, they need to come out and do something, and they're ready to work and fight through something as well. And so we want to make sure that we're there with them, and that we're supporting them, and that, you know, together we're all fighting through this.
Yeah, no, I think it's so amazing to see, you know, because we have a lot of just different gym partners in the community. Yeah. And so we've been observing too, and figuring out like the best ways to support, check in, amplify. We've actually been working on a couple of ideas on our end to add links on our website and support some of our like gym community members. Would love to add Boombox to this, but essentially creating a little bit of like a map to say like, hey, here's people in the Society 9 community who have started offering, you know, virtual classes or whatever. So then, you know, for our customer base, because they're from all over, they can go and see like, oh, wow, like, okay, like Boombox is offering both virtual and outdoor. I can decide what I want, but it's like a one-stop shop. So you hear that, people, it's coming, just wait. But yeah, it's basically kind of like a Yelp, but for the Society 9 community. So I'm really excited for that. And you know, it's the very least we could do to, you know, we're a small team too, but it's the very least we could do to help amplify, because the ocean rises all boats, right? So like, you know, we're definitely not operating in a silo. That's for sure. I can't agree with you enough on the whole. I mean, speaking as someone who is trying to keep up with a workout routine, I have to admit, and this is no shade on any gym, definitely no shade, but psychologically, the point that you're making about, you know, doing yet another virtual thing, it's like, oh my gosh, it's like an episode of Black Mirror, you know, it's like everything is on a screen.
Get me away from in front of this screen, right?
Yeah, so hard. And, you know, I've got a girlfriend who, she's been posting about this like online workout she's been doing, and it looks super inspiring. Like I want to do it, but literally in my head, I'm like, I don't want to allocate another hour to the screen. Yeah. Like, real talk. I'm like, I'll just do like 100 burpees outside. At least it's outside. And then that's my workout. You know, it's like,
it's so true.
Yeah. I saw on Instagram, I think it was Instagram. Did y'all do something recently at like a stadium?
We did. So our first outdoor classes were held at Audi Field, which is the home of the DC United soccer team.
Okay. No big deal. That's it. DC listeners, hear that? That's pretty sick. Like, get out there.
I must say it was a whole vibe. I mean, yeah. The stadium was huge. I mean, we actually had the class set at 45 people, all social distance. Mm-hmm. We had spacing of, I think, 10 square feet apart. But even then, we kind of did circuits where now we're broken out and we're operating all over the field. And it was great. It was so awesome. It was such energy. The DC United team was so supportive, and they actually were, you know, they were looking to help the community. I mean, we're at Boombox is literally, I think, a half a mile from the stadium.
Oh,
and so
sick.
For our members, yeah. So they literally walk in there. It was metro accessible. And I mean, we're using the stadium mic and the stadium sound.
Oh man. Yeah.
We're sweating it up, and we sold out every single week. And so that was pretty awesome. We definitely would have, and we still are managing that relationship, I think, with them, as with all sports right now. Even the sports teams are trying to figure out where they're going and where they're going to play. And some of the team came back. So that's been temporarily put on hold at Audi Field, but we're actually now popping up at Union Market, which is on a rooftop at Union Market, which is another super, super dope location in the city. And we're actually on turf now, looking over the city. And so that's actually pretty exciting too. And those start right at the end of this month, actually next week. So August the 24th would be the first one. So we're out there. That's we're trying awesome. To keep that boombox vibe, you know, because, yeah. You know, we're boxing, but we're boxing remix. So it has, it has to have a vibe. So
yeah,
we're pretty excited about that.
Man, I need that vibe in my life. Real talk. I need some real vibes. Yeah, that is awesome. You know, that kind of like inspires me to think about Portland a little bit. I mean, we're a much smaller market than DC, but just, you know, we're green and lush and it's summertime here. It's beautiful too. It'd be very interesting to do some different events, but thanks for the ideas. I don't know that.
Way more area than we do, as you said. Yeah. There are way more outdoor opportunities. So
I don't know that we possess the boombox vibe though. That'll be missing, but.
Society 9 has the vibe. I can tell you. I can tell you for myself. I can see it. And I'm all the way over here in DC.
Well, I appreciate that. We're trying out here. So, I mean, first of all, congrats to go from the fact that you were opening a year ago, which is crazy, and then now a year later going through this new journey and then having these more creative experiences that clearly are like really resonating with your community and emotionally bringing them back. And, you know, you're offering such a service because, you know, now you're giving people a taste of normalcy in a safe way, but then also, you know, an opportunity to really find something that can help them sustain. I think that's been probably the hardest thing for a lot of people as humans, just is that sustenance. I mean, I'm certainly struggling with that too. I mean, we all have. That's actually a great segue. How are you sustaining right now? I mean, you've had to focus on the business, but as a human being, how are you doing?
You know, it's so hard. You took the words right out of my mouth. Like we're all trying to sustain. And even when you, and none of us can give up our daily roles, right? Moms can't say, you know, I don't want to mother today because I'm not feeling well. We have our day jobs. We have other people that we're responsible for, you know, either supporting or encouraging or making sure they're well. And then you always have to determine whether or not do you feel guilty checking in with yourself? Is it okay checking in with yourself? If you do check in with yourself and you determine, I just don't feel like it today, is it okay to even say that out loud? Like you want other people to say that, but then you're asking yourself, can you really say that? And even if you say that out loud, again, is it okay for you to act on it and say, I just don't feel like it today. I just want to sit down and I just want to be, I don't feel like being on or doing these things. And so it's been a little bit of a challenge. I will say I have been able to get out and about. Interestingly enough, I right when I thought I was really going to be able to get out, I broke my wrist, Lynn. I broke my wrist. I just got my cast off 3 days ago. So I'm sitting here. I'm really supposed to be in a brace, but I have it airing out for a second. But, so for the last 7 weeks, when I thought I was going to be able to get out and get more active, now I'm just running around doing, you know, high knees, trying air squats still, you know, now the gym, I can't even hit a bag. So for me, I was like, this has got to be a dirty trick. Like, who is doing this to me? And how did I?
That just means that your jab is going to be so on point because you can only work one hand. I mean,
That's what my trainers, said at the same time.
So. Clarissa Shields. Her jab will knock anyone out. So I'm just saying, like
anybody.
Yeah.
Never want to be on the other side of that thing. But I think that, for me, it's getting better. I think for me, being around the members, being able to be out and engage and be in that space and feed off of that energy is really helping. And now, you know, that I don't have to do everything through a screen, just kind of being able to make small, meaningful connection points with people has been able to help. And then I think the most important thing is I gave myself permission to not feel guilty on days that I felt like I didn't want to, or that I wasn't feeling as okay. And I think, again, even asking yourself if you feel guilty was causing more guilt. But at some point I just said, you know, it's not okay. And our team and my friends and family, at some point it was just kind of like, you know, it's okay to take a break. And those breaks have always helped me come back even better and even stronger. So, I mean, I would venture to say I'm doing okay. And I thank you for asking. I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important that you have found that peace for yourself, because no one can take that and no one can dictate that for you, right? What you can or can't do in terms of setting boundaries and saying, you know what, I do need this for me. And especially, like, I can't imagine, as well as like leaders of the Black community, your local Black community too, the expectations, both the expectations on you, which is unfair, I should say, because like if anyone's expecting you to quote, fight your own battle, and then also on the other side, you know, there's newly woke people, as I call them, non-Black community members who mean well, but then they're turning to you as leaders of the Black community and like asking questions incessantly, I would imagine, just being like, what can I do? And you're just like, right. I just want to exist, you know? So how have you been able to both protect your time, right? Protect your time, your labor, your emotional labor, and then also realizing too that, like, you know, you have, as you said, employees to support and feed, your team to look out for, your own personal well-being. How have you navigated this time that, quite frankly, the Black community should never have had to ask for, right? If people were actually being treated truly equally in our system, how have you been protecting yourself from that? As you should, I want to emphasize that you should be protecting yourself from that, emotionally, but you know, how have you been able to navigate that?
I have to be honest. I have cycled the gambit of emotions. I've gone through a ton of them, and you know, I was raised in the South. So I was raised in Tennessee. So outside of being born Black, I was raised in the South, you know, where these types of things were, you know, very regular. Like, I'm first generation. I mean, my parents still went to segregated schools. And so, you know, it's hard to make it so real for people that this thing is not so long ago. Like, there, you know, when people say, yo, get over it, that was so old. And it was like my parents, not my grandparents. And I shared this with you before, Lynn, but like, you know, my parents still went to segregated schools, which my white counterparts, their parents went to segregated schools as well. Not their grandparents, their parents. So we are one generation removed from our legal form still of separation. And again, and as we already know, even after they became on paper no longer legal, they were still very much, these things were still very much happening. And then, you know, we fast forward to, you know, today I'm in a more progressive city, you know, where we live in.
Air quotes.
I live
in Portland, which is, quote, a progressive city, exactly, too, which, right. No shade, Portland, but come on now. Yes. Like y'all know.
Exactly. And it's very much of a melting pot. Yeah. And, you know, it's so funny, as you said, to see these new eyes awakening, and you're just kind of like, where have you been? Like, have mm-hmm. you been under this rock? And there's so many things now, you know, the thing is to catch everything on video, but I'm like, there've been tons of protests. I mean, even starting back way before, you know, even the Eric Garner days. And so,
right.
But now all of a sudden this one video hits different. And I do believe that it, you know, part of it, the quarantine was a blessing, you know, in disguise, because we didn't have all these other things that could distract us, and we could go on about our regular day, right? We were all sitting here, you know, in these spaces, and we had no choice but to look at our screens, because that's all that we're doing. And you can't go anywhere after. You can't just leave and go and, you know, the game's on, I'm switching it to basketball, I'm switching it to baseball, or, you know, I got drinks planned for later. So we were all focused in, and it made people realize that they couldn't block it out, and they had to pay attention. And at some point, I will say, I mean, my annoyance was heightened. I was very annoyed, and mm-hmm. more annoyed than you are on a daily basis. Cause again, you know, living in black skin, living in, you know, any colored skin, there's some level of, you know, every single day, you know, something's happening, someone's questioning, someone's looking over their shoulder, someone's crossing the street, even for me. And I'm a woman, and, you know, someone's unsure about your presence, about your existence, and why you're there, or in the room, or at the table. But then now all of a sudden people are like, oh my God, I cannot believe that this is happening to you. I can't believe this is ever happened. And, you know, and I have a black friend, and I have black friends, and you are my black friend. And, you know, I don't have a racist bone in my body. And my question, even to my friends, were like, well, have you talked to your other white friends? You're talking to me.
Right.
But have you been bold enough to talk to your other white friends? Are you just more comfortable having this conversation with me? Because I've overheard, you know, the jokes. And again, they weren't about me, but just generally inappropriate. And, you know, no one was questioned or checked or called out. But, you know, you want to have these bold now conversations with Angela. And I'm sure, like many, and I'm very aware, like many of my other friends or colleagues or family members have still had to take on the emotional labor of even trying to explain to someone very factual things, and also how you feel about something that's very, you know, either, excuse me, specific to your experience, and they're just not understanding. But, and, or now they're upset because, you know, you call them racist. I'm like, I didn't call you racist. I just said that that's not accurate, or that's not how that should have perceived, or that's maybe not how I received something you said. Mm-hmm. Now I'm calling you racist and all this other stuff. And I was like, where is this coming from? So
right.
it's been an interesting journey over the last couple of months. Again, with people that I love, that I care about, with my white friends, mm-hmm. and you know, other people that are closer, and even, you know, even some of my own other black people, because again, we all have our own experiences that we apply to life and this thing. And, you know, I've even given up and say, you know, I don't care. I'm going to continue to live my life, you know, treat people in the way that I deem is respectful. If there's something I need to learn or be challenged mm-hmm. on, let me listen and understand and apply and move forward in that space. And, you know, I've been sad at points as well.
Sure.
And it's really just like, you know, I have to figure out what's that thing in that moment that's going to get me through the day again. And it's whether I'm frustrated, I'm just going to go ahead and say what I have to say and walk off and close the door. Mm-hmm. Or I'm willing to sit down and have the conversation that day, or, you know, I'm sad that day, but I'm just like, you know, I'm going to talk through it and keep it moving. It's, it has been a challenge, but at the same time, I think for all of us, most of us anyway, there's been a lot of growth. If you've been willing to dig in, there's been a lot of growth.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'll be honest, I had a really random, interesting, and a very good learning experience very recently, actually. And this goes to show how deep racist languages in our vernacular that sometimes we might not even realize. Now, I consider myself a reasonably well-read person. I'm not the smartest person in the room, but I think I'm pretty reasonably well-read. I had made a comment recently to someone legitimately innocent. Like, I didn't even register. And I was making a comment about something being like cheap, but I used the word chintzy. Now, I'm a Vietnamese American woman, okay? I think I have a little bit of like Chinese ethnic, but it's like small. But the point is, I'm an Asian American woman, okay? I've been called a chink growing up. Mm-hmm. The person who was sitting across from me, who was white, said, "Hey, did you actually know that that's a racist word?" And I was like, my eyes just like bugged out. I was like, "Really?" And they were like, "Yeah, it actually originated, you know, back in the day when, you know, I mean, not that racism is gone, obviously, but back in the day when Chinese people immigrated to America, like the word chintzy emerged as a way to describe something as cheap because it was correlated negatively and derogatively to Chinese people." And I was like, "You're freaking kidding me." But that was like
something, because I actually didn't know that word,
right? And I mean, first I was embarrassed, of course. So I was like, I mean I was like I shouldn't be apologizing because like I am the Asian person in this situation. But I was like, but first of all, I apologize for using that language. That is not okay. Second of all, I legitimately didn't realize. Thank you for educating me, because I think that is the kind of, like, to your point, that's the kind of conversation we should be having this generation, that this stuff isn't that far removed, that it is actually so deeply embedded in things that we say that we don't even realize. And like I said, I'm very comfortable with, at least so far, the level of reading and education and information I take in on a regular basis. But even so, I'm still like freaking out that came out of my mouth, because I'm just like, holy cow. Right. So I don't blame you for just being like, you know what? I just want to live. I mean, that's kind of what you said about people not having distractions anymore, to all of a sudden have to, quote unquote, have to start caring about other humans. You sit here and you're like, well, why now? But then also you're like, well, thank God, you know, like
it's an interesting dynamic, because there is both sides. It's literally, as I said before, you know, it's like, welcome to the party. Where have you been? Mm-hmm. But you know, we have to face it. And it's not like, you know, you're there, you're at the door now, we can't, you know, say don't come in. Like we want to move forward. We have to, you know, allow those that want to learn, that are willing to open up and have the hard conversations, take the missteps, right? Because we're all gonna have them. They're gonna happen, but that's the part of the growth. But it really is frustrating to wonder, you know, if we weren't sitting here without all of our distractions, you know, would we be having this dialogue? But you know, I actually, for myself, had to sit up there and say, you know, Angela, that doesn't matter. Like, we're here now. The conversation is on the table in a very, very big way. I mean, they're saying, you know, we've had the biggest, you know, civil rights movement at this point in all of history, right? And it's cool because it's young people. It's, you know, young generations. They're very young, and they're understanding, and they're seeing
these high school students. Man, yes, I'm like,
that is what's so crazy. It's so crazy to see. And so, and they are very real, and they are very educated, and they're, you know, I mean, obviously we're at the, you know, the information is at your fingertips, and they're willing to challenge other people, their parents, you know, their grandparents.
It's really incredible.
I mean, I must say, I don't know if I would have went after my grandmother too much when I was younger, or like, that is absolutely crazy. Yeah. But you know, even still, in a way, I mean, they're doing it respectfully, but they're doing it firmly, and they're understanding, and they're learning, and they're challenging, and they're literally saying, you know, it's time that you see it a different type of way. Or like you said, it's time for you to realize that word is not okay. I mean, I live in DC now. The football team has been the Washington Redskins ever since I moved here, you know, and finally, you know, they decided to drop that name. And I remember, I mean, I wasn't a pro football fan growing up. My dad was, and he was in college football. But, you know, even when I first moved here, and everybody was like, well, what's the big deal? And I even had to learn for myself. Like, I literally had to stop and say, you know, what is this? I wasn't as familiar. And I educated myself. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's crazy. I can't believe they're really fighting back to, you know, get rid of this name. And it was crazy. And it took this moment. Ever since I moved to DC, I know this conversation has continuously repeated itself. And finally, it took this moment in 2020 for that team to finally say, you know, you're right. You're right. And right. drop this name, which is absolutely insane. But, you know, we're here now. So we'll take
We're here. Yeah. We're here.
We'll take it.
So how you're, you know, you share, thank you for sharing about your like family's history a little bit, but like, so how is your family doing? You know, how, especially when you're talking about, it's not, I don't even want to call it a generational divide because like you said, we're not even, I mean, they're still alive, you know? So it's like, it's not like this far, far off time ago. So how has your family been doing? How have they been, they, or you all, I should say, been navigating this time, especially since you're now ushering in your generation's legacy into your family in this time, and you know, and uniquely because your family was in the South or raised in the South and experienced the segregated schools and all that, you know, how have they been navigating this new chapter, I should say?
I'll say that, you know, my family is still in the South, and for them,
which state?
In Tennessee. So my family, I'm the only one and my younger sister who do not reside still in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So for my mom, for my immediate family and most of them, it's really still every day, you know, mm-hmm. it's for them, there hasn't been much of a change. And, you know, repeating the fact that I went to college in Memphis, I went to school in Tennessee, and my school was very racist. And mm-hmm. Memphis is a very Black town, at least the inner part of the city, like most inner cities. However, my college, my university was very much in the center of town, Rhodes College. Mm. And my first year there, you know, I was 4% Black, or minority total, I should say. And my school was very racist. And so for my family, for immediate family, I mean, this is still very much every day for them. I think now that we've seen, most of us have seen, people who are racist or have been underlying racist are now way more vocal than they used to be.
Interesting.
But in the South, they've always been more vocal. They've always been more ready to share their thoughts about you and how they feel than not. Mm-hmm. I will say, and we didn't get to talk about this before, but for my, you know, my dad, it's a little bit more interesting because a lot of people may not know this, even some of my team members here at Boombox. So my dad is a police officer and has been a police officer. I don't know. I think I was probably about 12 when he joined the police force, maybe a little earlier. But I know for him, it's my dad and my brother-in-law. And for them, I am very aware that obviously the dynamics have changed. You know, it's no longer the excitement about, you know, Mr. McGruff and the police officers coming to the school and talking about, you know, police and the neighborhood and how they're here to protect you, because now so many of our children are afraid and scared of the police. And it's unfortunate because I do, you know, remember that, you know, when my dad's biggest thing was always kids. He actually policed in his neighborhood that he grew up. So it was actually even more important for him to connect with the young children, especially the little boys that were coming up in the neighborhood, and he saw them going off on the right path because it wasn't the greatest neighborhood. It was in South Memphis. Mm-hmm. And it was very important for him. But he also was recognizing, as those six-year-olds turned into 16-year-olds, that, you know, that feeling, that trust of the police was changing. It was definitely very, very different. And of course, it was due to how they're being treated. Now, there is something to be said about majority Black police force policing a majority Black town. That absolutely does make a difference, because there's a level of empathy there and a relatedness there that they can connect to. However, I also understand the concept that if no good cop snitches on and you can use the word snitch, you can use the word stop, whatever the word we want to use, mm-hmm. but if no good cop stops or reports the actions of a bad cop, then are there really any good cops, right? Mm-hmm. And we're talking about, you know, and it's funny, I used to talk to my dad about this all the time, where, you know, my dad is, we used to always complain about, you know, people don't want to, you know, I'm trying to, you know, resolve a crime, or we're out here trying to get people off the street, and all you kids are concerned about is I'm not a snitch, or I'm not snitching. And I remember one day I was like 18 or 20, and I wasn't the best child either. Like, I'll just tell you, I was a piece of work.
Different journey, different conversation for another podcast episode. No, I'm just kidding.
Seriously. And I remember asking my dad, I say, I feel like you all never snitch. And, you know, and police brutality wasn't on the level as it is now in terms of people talking about it and awareness. We're not going to say it did not exist, because it very much did. Mm-hmm. However, I just remember saying to him, you all are the worst no snitch people. Mm. And even now, the conversation.
You're talking, just to clarify, you mean internally, the police order, not.
Correct, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Not the, and not like.
Snitching on each other, exactly. Yeah. And I was just like, you know, when something happens in between, you know, you all and someone has done something wrong and you need to address that, no one has said anything. And I've been on the other side of, you know, just generally, and this is over the years of, you know, just growing up around my dad and just being around the police force in general and just understanding how it works. So at this point, you know, now I know a lot of police officers, at least during that time that I was still living in Memphis, and, you know, understanding the mindset of, you know, kind of how they're trained to either say they saw something or trained to say, you know, I don't necessarily.
The trainings, what quote unquote. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, again, I don't take anything away from my dad in terms of what he really wanted to do. And again, I do believe there's so many cops out there, and just like everyone else, they're concerned about their livelihood, their
family,
their jobs. But, you know, it's been interesting to see, and I can't see him because I'm not in Memphis to really see mm-hmm. or gauge how he feels, or the same for my brother-in-law and some of the other family friends that we have. That are on the police force, but I can tell that, you know, you've seen, you know, they have a heightened sense of awareness, a heightened concern for now their safety, because we're seeing that people are willing to fight back. People are willing to stand up for themselves, at least on some level. People are having the conversations out loud more often than not. And they run the gamut of emotions too, in terms of, you know, they're saying either not me, or, you know, we're trying to do what's best for the community. We're trying to.
As officers.
Officers, excuse me. And the people just don't understand. And, you know, it's been interesting to see that story unfold on the other side, so close to home. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, where they, and I know they're still cycling through emotions. I don't know where the answer is, but it's very sensitive conversation to raise and to have, to say the least.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, it's still always that, what about me? And let me be clear. I think my dad has always, and I know for sure my brother-in-law and other people that I know, like, they've always, again, been for the people, right, to some extent, and they want things to be, you know, and they call out wrongs, right? They can call out wrongs generally. The question that I've always asked them was, though, but what if that was your partner or someone on your team, right? It's always easier when it's across the country, when it's another state, another city, but if that was your partner and you saw that happen, would you have allowed them to either lie on the police report or take those extra shots? Or did you feel like they even needed to pull out, you know, their gun, when we're talking about police brutality and all these things that happen? So my family, in terms of them, it's like very interesting, because if I didn't have a police officer in the family, it'd probably be a little bit of a different conversation, but that's added on some layers that, you know, otherwise would not be there. But, you know, outside of that, I will say, like, they're doing fine. They're doing well. My mother's probably more concerned about me than anything. She's like, you're in that big city, and I just want to make sure you're okay. And
as mothers do. Yeah.
And protesting. And I, you know, if you need to come home, just come home.
Yeah. Like,
you know, I am okay. But, you know.
Also, I'll knock a bitch out.
Yeah, like, seriously. I'm just like, listen.
I got that jab right now. Forget my broken wrist.
I told my mom, like, you know, I have been fighting since the beginning. I mean, you like, Angela, get back in here. So, yeah. Like, don't worry about me. But, you know, they're fine. But I can tell you, my mother's biggest, you know, change or worry is her and, I mean, her being in Memphis and me being here and here with all these things that are going on around this, you know, crazy president.
Yeah.
And he's just like, just, you know, just come home if you need to. And I was like, I'm not going down there. Y'all crazy down there too. So
everything's crazy.
Everybody's crazy.
Yeah.
So it's been they're good, but it's interesting to see the cycle that's going through the police in my the police officers that are in my family and are in our family circle.
First of all, I feel very, very honored and humbled that you trust us to share your family's journey, both like in the past as well as now currently, with navigating yourselves as, I mean, all of you are leaders in your respective black communities, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's Memphis or DC now, but then also trying to navigate that intersection of,
yeah.
you know, being a uniformed family and then, or a family under the uniform, and then also as a, you know, as Black people in this country. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. I had an interesting conversation, like your point about you've never known really how to ask your dad and your brother-in-law, like the question of like, you know, it's easy to sit here and say, you know, I would never hide or lie on the police report, whatever, you know, but to your point, if it hits home, what would you do? You know, and I had an interesting conversation recently with a veteran who, you know, has friends who are on the police force, but mm-hmm. he on a personal level, does believe that police brutality is a massive issue. But as a former serviceman, he, of course, a fellow man in uniform, he sympathizes, yeah. of course, with the police force and the very things that you're talking about, you know, that your father and your brother-in-law also struggle with, which is, and this individual used this word that like made a lot of sense to me. I don't know why I heard it. And I was like, okay, well, that explains why psychologically this is a lot more complicated than, yeah, like, yes, there's the race issue, but then there's this psychological piece, which he said, and I'm paraphrasing, they basically was like, even though like the individual can see the act is clearly wrong in front mm-hmm. of their eyes, when you know, join the service, whether it's military or the police, which unfortunately, quite frankly, in this country, it's basically military, mm-hmm. especially the way that it fundamentally treats its citizens, right? And the kind of weaponry they have and all that kind of stuff. He was saying that at the end of the day, what makes it really difficult to just switch gears mentally to, you know, quote unquote, just say that this is wrong is that yeah. you've been trained through academy or through boot camp or whatever to defend your fellow brothers and sisters in arms at all costs. Because you've been trained essentially this idea of, and this is only one man, and he's a white man, it's only one man's perspective, but he was just saying that like, you're wired to, you know, both literally and kind of metaphorically, like take a bullet for these people, right? Mm-hmm. So then when you're talking about loyalty and this like fraternal order, like that is what you're talking about breaking, which is why they're so like, when people say things like blue lives matter, even though yeah. it's like blue is not a human, it's, you know, but the sentiment that he was trying to explain, not justify, which I appreciated him clarifying. He was like, I'm not justifying, but like to clarify why psychologically it's a lot more complicated than, you know, just black and white. I don't mean that racially, but just, you know, it's a very gray complex, especially when people have, you know, sworn an oath, whatever this idea of an oath means to an individual, and then to don the uniform, whatever the uniform means to them, to the individual. There's so many powerful layers there that, you know, and so here, thinking about what he said and then hearing your family story, I can only imagine that complexity, mm-hmm. you know, and for you, has it been difficult for you to manage, especially because you have your own opinions, of course, and you, at least personally, are not someone who dons the uniform, even though you're the daughter of two individuals or a family member of two individuals who don the uniform, you know, have you been able to navigate both pain and anger as well as love. Like how has the intersection of that, those emotions, you know, what has that journey been like? Or you just take it a day at a time?
I truly am just taking it a day at a time. And it's almost like, even for them, and I hate to say this, but it literally is almost like you're compartmentalizing as well, mm-hmm. right? And the beauty for me, and when you're raised as a daughter or something like that, you know, my brother-in-law, I met him, but I didn't meet him as the police officer. Sure. I met him as the person my sister was dating, or the same thing with my dad. I mean, you know, before this became a thing, but now obviously I'm old enough, I'm aware, and I understand the impacts and what this thing means, this role that he plays. And I have moments, I do have moments where I'm just thinking about, I wonder what, you know, he would have done, or mm-hmm. has he done this, you know, right? I mean, we all get to we all get to tell as much of our history as we want to, and nobody else knows it, right?
Totally.
And so I try not to dwell on that and give that moment for that space, because again, you know, you're trying to take this big thing that's over here and figure out how to apply it to your life. And it's kind of like, you know, well, let me allow them the space and the grace to even cycle through their things and figure out, you know, what's really happening. And maybe for them, like we all are, maybe they are checking themselves, you know, maybe they are, you know, thinking back and asking themselves how they could have done something differently. Or maybe they're sitting there determining moving forward, you know, how they will handle something differently. I haven't had that conversation with them. I don't know. But for me internally, it's really just taking it a day at a time. And at this point, like if something presents itself naturally in a conversation, I'll raise it and I'll talk about it. I was just at home and I want to say June. And, you know, one thing came up briefly that we kind of talked about and discussed, but, you know, in that period of time, we didn't have super deep conversations, at least about the police officers in general. At least at that point in time, my mom was just like, you're here and I'm just going to hug on you and I don't want to talk about anything else at this point. But, you know, it really is just taking it a day at a time and like let it organically evolve with them, mm-hmm. You know, as it relates. Because the other part about this, Lynn, that we're not talking about and that I hadn't raised is they're also Black men living yeah. in a society that does not necessarily favorably treat Black men. So they also have that aspect that they're dealing with as well. Mm-hmm. And so again, with so many of these things, like you already mentioned, there's so many layers. There is just all these kind of complex intersections and dynamics that we're all kind of cycling through and dealing with that, you know, is really just one of those things that we all kind of have to just take one day at a time and really try to, you know, figure it out and you know, how to deal yeah. and how to respond.
Yeah. I feel like what I hope for everyone, but especially it's on, in my opinion, at least it's on non-Black people, regardless of whether you don uniform or not. But, yeah. I do hope, like you said, that even if change doesn't happen immediately, cause you only wish it could, right?
It never does.
And you wish it could, because like all we're really talking about here is like, it's a human rights issue. We're talking about fair human treatment. And so, but as we're talking about the layers of identity that, we've either chosen, or gained in terms of power. So, you know, yes, earning the power of the uniform as your father has, but at the same time being a Black man, right? It's like you can only hope and pray that his own colleagues then are thinking about that intersectionality, right? Of like, no, this isn't just a brother in arms. It's, oh yeah, as soon as he takes off this uniform, my very own colleague could racially profile him.
Yeah, and because, we've seen it happen. We've seen it happen all the time.
And so I think that's like, that's what I hope and pray for, is that that mental switch, that systemic change beyond just law, but like, can people, and this is a non-rhetorical question, but it's just like, can people right now in 2020, because all this change is happening so quickly, like, can the ways that people think and look at people fundamentally change right now, because like this idea of intersectionality is finally starting to maybe be more presence of mind, that now finally those, you know, white officer colleagues no longer sees your father and your brother-in-law as like, oh yeah, they're just my like fellow police officers. It's like, no, he's a police officer and he's a Black man. Like, you know, and I hope, whether it's in the uniform setting or just walking out in the world, I mean, that's what I'm like, not to sound like she, hippie dippy, whatever, but it's just like, we're talking very serious issues here, and I'm not trying to like throw toxic positivity on the situation either, because racism is real freaking serious and like people's lives are on the line, but it's like, I keep praying to God that like that's what's happening, like from an existential standpoint, is that yeah. People are now, when you're walking down the street and you see, you know, your POs, neighbors of color, and you're finally like, you're no longer just thinking like, you know, I'm not racist, I don't see color. It's like, no, you should see the color.
I hate that phrase. Like hate those words. It drives me nuts every time someone says it. I lose it every single time. So I just reacted to it just because you said it out loud. It just completely triggers me. I'm like, why do people say that? Why do they think that's an amazing thing to say? Like, why do they think that is the way to go?
Right. Well, I mean, it's a form of toxic positivity, right? It's framed, it's got good intentions, but what people I feel like tend to not realize who say that is like, okay, well now you're erasing or negating the very real experiences that we live. I mean, even as a woman who's white passing, like I'm white passing just because I'm a lighter skinned Asian American woman, but yeah. I'm 100% Asian American. I am not white, and therefore I am not equal by way of the way, whether it's pay equity or a business equity, or I mean, even just the way I walk down the street, you know, like the fact that I was scared to wear a mask for a while and had a lot of anxiety because of the Asian fueled racism due to coronavirus, you know, like that was a new experience for me. And, you know, and then worrying about my parents going to Costco and getting yelled at by some racist ass people, you know, it's just like, so
crazy.
So people don't ever, please don't ever say you don't see color. Cause it's like, just stop.
Just stop. At least not around me. Cause I will say something. Look at me. I'm Black. I'm blackity black, black. So let me help you. If you can't see it, I'm going to tell you, and now you're going to know.
Right. So tell them. But, first of all, thank you. I want to respect your time, because we usually have, you know, our podcasts are usually about an hour, and but I appreciate you teaching me something, first of all, and it's not your job to be teaching me, but by having this conversation, you've, you know, undoubtedly have taught me. I know you've certainly taught our listeners and our community too. So thank you for sharing your experiences. Whatever we can do to support you, and, you know, and just whether it's cheering on the business or, you know, whatever we can do to continue to support and amplify your voice, the Black community's voice, you know, without even question, like, please. And also, like, I'm going to state this publicly, because yes, I mean it, like, call us out. If we ever post something on Instagram or put something on the website that you're like, I wonder if Lynn or like the team like realizes this, call us out. That goes for anyone. Like, please do. Like, I mean, if my anecdote earlier about the usage of chintzy taught you anything, like, you know, correct me, correct us. Like, this is the only way we can change. And then, you know, and I humbly ask that of you and anyone else, that I, as the owner of this business, like, I welcome it.
And that goes for both of us. I thank you. I think the biggest thing that you've done, Lynn, is really keep the conversation going, right? And shown that it's not a fad. It's not, you know, a Black box on a Tuesday. It's not, you know, buy Black Thursday or anything like that. It's, you know, activism and racism didn't happen overnight. And changing it is not going to happen overnight. It calls for continued conversation, continued dialogue, in this case, continued protest. You know, I think that, you know, so many people complained about the protest, but this year and in this last couple of months is when the most we've gotten done in a short period of time around changes as it relates to systemic racism than we've had in years past put together. And so, you know, again, thank you for keeping the conversation going and keeping us all, you know, accountable and making us, you know, continue to look internally, check ourselves. Like you said, you talked about the Chinzi. I'm always learning and checking myself with other races and also, and especially for me, I would say even with the LGBTQ community, we're all learning. All of these things are being brought to the table and we can no longer say we weren't aware, we don't know, or we can't go and learn about it on our own. So again, thank you. And I ask the same thing in return. If you see anything as of us, you know, help us keep ourselves accountable as well so that we can all learn and grow together and do our part in making sure that we're all figuring this thing out. And we're just trying to create a society that is more inclusive, that is allowing all of us to just be somewhat equal. That's all we're asking for. I mean, the words are Black Lives Matter, not better, not more important. It's matter. That's very basic. It's not asking for a lot. Right. And that's really all we want. You know, we want to be able to live in harmony, live cohesively, and live safely, just as with everyone else.
Absolutely. And, you know, my commitment, you know, with Society as a business owner, but also like with Society9, the fortunate, the fact that we're so fortunate to have a platform and a community, you know, the commitment that I'm making, is that we continue the conversation and take action, of course, but it's all centered around the idea of what it means to, I've used this phrase before, and it's just like, it's something I just so deeply and fervently believe in. I think it's, I was raised Buddhist, but I think is where it comes from. But this idea of like collective humanity, do our actions, do our words, do they ultimately feed into this belief, this idea of a collective humanity, which is why, like, you know, us talking about your father's experience in the police force and his experiences as a Black man and what that intersectionality is like, it's like, okay, well, what we're talking about here is like that is his humanity, and he is asking to be acknowledged and recognized, you know, as such in both of his worlds, as a Black man and also as a Black man in uniform, as a police officer in those spaces. And so whatever we can do to keep on committing to having those conversations, because you're right, it is about active consciousness. And I think that's from my perspective, because the social justice issues do matter to me. What I fear, as understandably you do too, is that it started with the Black Square and now it's like gone and we're back to selfies and stuff, which is fine. We all need to feel good about ourselves, but it's like, we have to remember that the more that these conversations don't leave, the more that it actually sticks in ourselves, in our brains, and we actually start integrating it into action, even if it's a small action.
Absolutely.
So I'm making this commitment, like, I've been making this commitment, but I'm just reiterating my commitment, especially after this conversation with you. So keep us to that. To our listeners, can you let us know where to follow you, where to go to check out Boombox? We'll also make sure, of course, to put the information on the episode, but for the listeners, we can...
Absolutely. Please find us on Instagram at boombox_boxing. You can find us online at www.boombox-boxing.com. Again, we're in Washington, D.C., but we're holding classes virtually now outside as well as in our beautiful D.C. studio. So we'd love to have all of you and come and check us out. It's a vibe.
You heard? Yeah, it's a vibe. Check it out. Thank you, Angela. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Take care.